welcome to another episode of True Stories of Tinseltown, and I am so thrilled to have this guest. His name is Stone Wallace, and he wrote a magnificent book entitled, and I love it, and you will too, and you don't even have to like, I'm going on and on, George Raft, the man that would be Bogart, right?
Actually, it's the man who would be Bogart.
Yeah, that's what I said. Yeah, the man who would be Bogart. Okay, and it's a great book. I read it all. And George, it was so good. What made you choose to write a book on George Raft?
Well, I've been a huge fan of George Raft ever since 1972. I spent the summer in Chicago that year, and they were playing some old movies, which we didn't really get up here in Winnipeg too often. So I was watching a lot of the old classics, which I've always had a fondness for. And one night they were playing a movie called Each Dawn I Die.
I love that.
Always a big fan of, it's a great film, but I was always a fan of James Cagney, of course. Didn't know too much about Raft, but I watched that movie, and he just completely mesmerized me with the tough guy performance
that he gave.
Oh, my God.
You know,
he was the criminal with the heart of gold, and I just thought, this guy has really got something. I mean, it's always been said that George Raft wasn't the world's greatest actor, but he had a presence, and I certainly absorbed that presence the night that I watched that film.
He was
so
amazing.
Along with Cagney.
Yeah.
He was totally amazing. He just had that way about him. And then, you know, because I became an instant admirer of his work, I began checking him out and wanted to find out more about his career, his personal life. And through the years I did that, I just began trying to track down his films and read whatever I could about him. And along with Cagney, Bogart, Robinson, and John Garfield, he became in my top group of favorite actors.
They're wonderful. Every one of them. I'm a humongous fan of Edward G. Robinson. You know, maybe he's not the handsome. I can't want to talk manpower with you later, but
yes.
So much. John Garfield just had that presence, that real presence.
Yes.
And I loved, you know what? I like Bogey too. You know, and who else did you say?
Cagney.
I love Jimmy Cagney, and he must have liked George, because he said something about George, you know, he could do the fastest Charleston he ever saw. And
They were very good. They were very good friends, actually. Yes, indeed.
Okay, so why don't we start? Why don't you give us a little bit of background info, like from where is George from and all that stuff?
Well, of course, George was born in Hell's Kitchen, New York, which is a tough neighborhood.
Now it's trendy. I live there.
Really? Oh,
yes.
See, I've never been there. I've always been interested. I was in Manhattan some years ago, but I never went into the Hell's Kitchen area because I should have, actually, out of curiosity. But as you know, back in the day when George was born, growing up there, that was a tough neighborhood. And as George said in one interview, he says there were only two ways to escape this neighborhood was through sports or crime. And actually, George pretty much did both. As a young man growing up, he didn't have much education. He tried various sporting activities, you know, baseball, boxing. But where he really found his niche was with dancing. He just had a natural ability. And through dancing, you know, he got into the clubs. And his career pretty much started from there.
You know, it's so funny because I'm reading it and I see that he tried out for a minor league team in Springfield, Massachusetts, my hometown. So Georgie baby was there, but I was yet to be a twinkle in my parents' eyes. And I don't even think
there
my parents were a twinkle in their parents' eyes yet. But yeah, so he learned, how did he learn to dance?
He just picked up steps, basically. He hung around dance halls, I believe, you know, and he was kind of trying to find his way in the world. And again, no education, no special skills. He, you know, crapped out as far as sports went, although he maintained a lifelong love of baseball and boxing. And he began hanging around these dance halls and just had a natural ability to pick up steps, which he kind of improved upon and began entering contests and just grew from there, actually, until he was hired by some of the nightclubs and really developed a strong reputation there and eventually found his way dancing on Broadway.
I want to ask you this one question. He did not like his father, I guess because his father did not like him. What age was it he when he left the house?
Oh, he was, I think he was just his early teens.
Yeah.
Early teens. I mean, his father was a very strict Germanic type of man.
Yes, the Aryan, right? He was really Aryan.
Yes, I believe so. And George actually didn't even look like his father or his brothers. I mean, they were blonde and they had the German look to them, as you said. Whereas George really inherited more of his mother's looks. So there was always kind of a problem. And plus, you know, George was kind of a wayward child. He was kind of on his own from a young age. So, you know, his father, I suppose, expected more from him. And George kind of was a street kid. So there never was a real closeness between the two of them.
But he had one with his mom. He was always close to moms, right?
He was very close to it. Very, very, just like James Cagney, very close to their mothers. You know, their mothers pretty much kept them as close as possible in the straight and narrow. George was a little bit, you know, less successful than Jimmy was because he did get involved in, you know, criminal activities, minor stuff for the most part. But, you know, he was a street kid. He, you know, belonged to street gangs like the Gophers, you know, became a childhood friend of Oney the Killer Madden, you know, which was part of, you know, his advancement in the underworld to a point.
Mm-hmm. So he did dance on Broadway, but I want to ask you this beforehand, because I'm really not certain what this is. He was a taxi dancer. What is a taxi dancer?
That is when you went into a tea room. And women, usually, you know, middle-aged, unattractive women would come in there and they would pay for a dance.
Like 10 cents a dance, a dine a dance for women.
10 cents a dance, whatever they would charge. It was, and so they would dance. So that's where he met Rudolph Valentino, who he bore a striking resemblance to, because he was a taxi dancer as well, Valentino. And they both were in the same place at the same time, became friends, but they were both very popular among these women who would come in there and want to have a little bit of, you know,
attention
and dance time.
Taxi
sometimes
dancer.
sometimes probably expecting a little bit more, but I never really got into that too much, so.
No, that's hard to tell. And so then
that's hard to tell. Yeah,
how did he get into Broadway?
Well, he was discovered through his dancing in the nightclubs, and they were putting together shows, and they realized he had the ability to be a Broadway dancer. He was, you know, at best at what he did, actually, and he was approached to appear. I believe the show was called City Chap, if I'm not mistaken. I have to remember that, but he did the dancing on the Broadway stage,
and then
what happened.
Did he get discovered, or did he move out to L.A.?
Well, the thing is, he ran into some trouble with an underworld figure, and his pal Oney Madden asked him. He was good friends with Texas Geenan, who you might know. She was the model for the Gladys George character in the Roaring Twenties, actually.
Oh, I love Gladys George. She was such a hard dame with a heart of gold. Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. Anyway, Texas Geenan was the model for that character. She was a nightclub hostess. She was going to go to Hollywood to make her first movie called The Queen of the Nightclubs. And since George was in a little bit of trouble with a mob figure, Oney Madden suggested that he accompany her to Hollywood. And she got him a very brief bit part in a movie called The Queen of the Nightclubs, like I said. He was supposed to be doing a dance sequence, but really that was cut out of the movie. And you see him very briefly as a band leader waving a baton, a scene that was later put into a Jimmy Cagney movie called Winner Take All. And that was the beginning. He liked the show business in Hollywood. When he went back to New York, he saw, you know, things were changing there. It wasn't the same New York he knew. So he decided he wanted to try his luck in Hollywood. And Oney Madden bankrolled him because he thought that George had potential. So it was, you know, a tough few years while he was, you know, doing some bit parts and everything. But he was finally discovered by director Roland Brown, who wanted him to appear as Spencer Tracy's bodyguard in a movie called Quick Millions. And that basically was the start of his film career.
Did he? It seemed like they had sort of a mercurial relationship.
Who's that?
George and Tracy. Didn't he slug
him? They had one minor blow up because, you know, this was Tracy's, you know, first big part, and George was nervous as well. He's untried as an actor. He wasn't sure, you know, if he, you know, could handle a part like that. And apparently they had a bit of a run in at a country club waiting for a scene to be filmed. But they worked it out. It was kind of a silly little thing. And Tracy actually ended up apologizing to George. They became good friends afterwards.
Good. So that was that. I never saw that movie. And then wasn't he offered? When was the street scene? What is it? The one that they had the East Side Kids and.
Oh, you're talking Dead End.
Dead End. What time? Oh,
that was much. That was 1937.
Oh, so he had done tons of others.
He'd done lots of films.
Was Night After Night his film debut as a star of a show?
Yep, that was his first starring role. Don't forget, after Quick Millions, he played Paul Muni's bodyguard.
Oh my God, he was wonderful.
That's the film that catapulted him to fame, you know, as the coin-flipping gangster Gino Rinaldo.
Yeah.
And that was the movie that made Hollywood take notice of him, and contract offers came in. He was still not under any studio contract at that time, but offers came in from various studios, and he signed with Paramount and did a couple films for them, Dancers in the Dark, and I think he did a freelance. I'm not sure if it was before or after Scarface. He did a movie at Universal called Night World, and then he was offered.
Oh, I know what that is. Not a great flick. Yeah.
No, it's actually about an hour in length, but I have a DVD copy of it, but it's not really a terrific movie, that's for sure. But then, you know, with Paramount, they put him in. He did a picture called Madame Racketeer with Alison Skipworth, another gangster part, small part. And then Paramount thought it was time to give him a lead, and they offered him Night After Night, which he was kind of reluctant to take because he didn't know if he was ready to accept a starring role in a picture. But he did, and he did okay, and that was, again, another step forward in his career.
I thought, you know, I just rewatched that movie last night, and he also, it was a cute movie, and I thought he was really adorable in it. And it had Alison Skipworth as a tutor, his older tutor. And was this the film debut of Mae West?
Yes, it was. In fact, Paramount initially wanted to cast Texas Geenan in the role of Maudie. And George said, look, Texas would be good, but I know somebody who'd be sensational. And he recommended Mae West. And, of course, that started her career. Like George Raft said shortly after the film was released, that Mae West stole everything but the camera.
She was great.
Because people sometimes forget that George Raft is in the movie because she has such a, you know, colorful part. And I think she probably, you know, wrote a lot of her own dialogue.
Yes, so, I know. Yeah. The first part. Oh, goodness, look at that jewelry.
Yes.
Goodness had nothing to do with it, dearie.
I think it's that line that made her a star, actually.
Yeah, because that was really her big first line.
Yes.
There. And,
yes, indeed.
She was adorable. And he falls in love with Constance Cummings, who is this, like, he thinks she's a dream girl, Miss Class with a K. Just wonderful. And she comes in alone every night, and he's very intrigued by her. And, that, you know, he tries to impress her and stuff, and they go to dinner. And Alison Skipworth and May is there. And I love the next morning when May and Alison wake up in bed together. Alison has a horrible headache. And May's taking care of her. And then May asks, hey, you should work for me. And she said, well, aren't I a little too old for that? But it was for the beauty parlor. What's it called?
Right.
Institute de Butte.
Okay. I haven't seen that film for a while, actually. But, yeah, it's a cute little movie.
It is, and it goes fast, and it's he was pretty charming, and I liked him.
Oh, yeah. He played a good character in that one. Yeah, he was very likable in that. And the whole film, is like I say, is cute. It's fun. And it obviously, you know, didn't hurt George's career because from then on he began doing, you know, lead roles in the Paramount movies.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he was. What was his next role?
Oh boy, I'd have to have my book in front of me to remember offhand.
Okay. I have the IMDb right here. So let's.
Okay.
Check.
Yes. See what's after. Yes.
Oh wow, he did a lot of stuff.
Did a lot of. He might have done Undercover Man next. I'm trying to think from memory here.
Queen Night, Gold Digger, Side Street, Quick Millions, Goldie, The Pickpocket, Hush Money, Palmy Days.
Palmy Days, with Eddie Cantor.
Eddie Cantor. Didn't you like Jimmy Durante, too? Were they friends?
They were very good friends, absolutely. In fact, early in George's career, he worked at Jimmy's nightclub, the Club Durant.
The Club Durant. That sounds so...
Yeah, and Jimmy knew that George wasn't doing too well in those days, and he said, look, if ever you're a little bit short of cash, he says, just help yourself to the cash register. And so one night George was, and he went to put his hands in the cash register, and one of Jimmy Durante's employees, who didn't know that they made that deal, went and slammed the register on George's hands that was breaking his fingers.
Poor George. Yeah, so then, you know, we didn't speak about, he was married before he moved to Hollywood to this, whom I'm going to say, give me a break. She couldn't get a divorce because of her Catholic faith. Wasn't she cheating on him all the time when they first got married?
I don't think she was cheating. Well, apparently she did have quite a background, you know, that she wasn't the chaste and pure girl that George had believed she was.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah, she claimed, yeah, she got Grace Mulrooney, she always claimed that she wouldn't divorce George because of her staunch Catholicism. But there was always this, you know, the rumor going around that she was doing very well to be married to George because she was getting 10% of his earnings during his, you know, palmy days in Hollywood.
Yeah.
So, you know, to divorce him and maybe get a settlement when she realized being married over the long run would be more, you know, profitable for her. And that, to me, seems more the likely story.
I think so. It just seems she wasn't a very nice woman. But they never lived together, right? I think they'll see that for a while.
I think basically after their honeymoon, you know, that was it. I think, you know, they went their separate ways. And it's unfortunate it was a mistake George made because he did have, you know, some very serious Hollywood romances. And he claimed later on in life that, you know, like Betty Grable, Virginia Pine, he would have married both of them had he been free, and apparently tried to get a divorce from Grace. But she was staunchly refused him. She just would not, you know, even when he offered her a pretty hefty cash settlement, she just, you know, wouldn't do it. So George basically... The interesting thing is he's, you know, one of Hollywood's most famous playboys, yet technically he was one of the longest marriages in Hollywood,
Isn't
if you think about
funny?
It.
Funny? Yeah, well, it's sort of
because
like...
Because they never divorced.
Spencer Tracy also, you know, he had that long marriage, and he had multiple flings. But what I was going to ask about George, so you got into some of his love life. Who was the first woman he fell in love with? Was it the socialite that married Clark Gable later?
No, well, he did have he dated Carol Lombard. I don't know how serious that relationship was. I mean, he loved her, but the first real serious relationship he had was with a woman named Virginia Pine. She was a socialite.
And I think Clark's third wife or fourth wife.
No, she had nothing to do with Clark.
Huh. Oh, so I'm
nope,
wrong.
No,
so,
no, no. Virginia Pine had nothing to do with Clark. She was a socialite. She had a daughter. She was married before. She had a daughter, Joni, who George adored. And when he built his house in Coldwater Canyon, he actually built it for her and Joni, the daughter, hoping eventually that he'd be able to marry her and they could move in as a family because he didn't want to move in with her, you know, unmarried. And unfortunately, again, you know, George was trying to obtain a divorce from his wife, apparently. And she refused, and because of that, their relationship started to fall apart, and she eventually moved out, married Quentin Reynolds, a journalist, and George and his companion, Mac Gray, moved into the house together, and that was the end of that relationship.
Yeah, everyone reads, like, he spent 2 years with the women, because that was the time pretty much, like, it's over. You're not going to be able to get a divorce. I got to move on. I want to be married. And you can't blame them. And he was also heavily involved with Betty Grable, who he loved dearly.
Yes, yes. And that was reciprocated. Betty Grable said later, she says, I was so in love with George Raft, I would have married him the first week. You know, but again, it was the same situation. Once again, he tried to obtain a divorce from Grace, and she, you know, refused. And that relationship fell apart as well. She ended up marrying Harry James, the band leader. And after that, George said, you know what, I've had it trying to, you know, with a serious relationship. He dated a lot of women and, you know, that, but he never really got seriously involved with anyone again after that.
What about Norma Shearer?
Because he realized, what's the point? Well, that was out of the three serious relationships, that was probably the least of them. I mean, he loved her. He loved the kids, you know, Irving Thalberg's son and daughter,
uh-huh.
Catherine and Irving Jr., and, you know, treated them like, you know, he loved kids and was like a father figure to them. But again, I don't think that relationship was quite as serious as Virginia and Betty. And again, you know, it kind of fell apart. She was under contract to MGM, and Louis Mayer wasn't really happy about the relationship. He said, a nice Jewish girl like Norma shouldn't be seen with a roughneck like George Raft. And so there was a lot of pressure put on them as well at that time. So that fell apart. But he always, I think, maintained, you know, some kind of a relationship, a friendly relationship, I think, with some of them. I know he did with Betty Grable after a pretty bad breakup, let's put it that way.
Yeah, and he also had a romance with May, but that was just like a flingy fling fling in New York, right? But they were lifelong friends.
They were close friends. I mean, you know, there was a bit of a romance there, like you say, in New York in those days, but they became just, you know, very good friends and great admiration of each other.
Okay.
And of course, she was indebted to him because, you know, he gave her her film career.
She was adorable in that. I loved her. You know, and how old was she? Like 35 or something? And she comes in.
She was older than. Well, that was 32, and George was born in 1895, and she was born before him. So yeah, she would have been in her mid 30s.
Yeah, somebody said they don't get her in that movie because she's fat and old. I'm like, well, if you don't get her in that movie, there's something wrong with you. I mean, she's just a riot, and she.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. She's so great.
You can see why you can see why that movie made her a star and her career was so successful. You know, she was brassy and she just had a quality you didn't usually see in women in Hollywood at that time.
And proud of it. You know, she was proud of
all
that.
And proud of it.
And she was a writer and she did a lot of incredible things. And I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely.
George admired her and she was a faithful friend. And
yes.
Then he got in trouble with the studios. He got suspensions, right?
Oh yeah, he held the record for suspensions at Paramount. He was turning down so many good parts, which unfortunately, you know, wasn't good for his career. He was offered so many good parts that he, you know, that's I suppose one of the stories about George is how he's one actor who totally, you know, put the shotgun to his own career there. At Paramount, he turned down parts like in Beau Geste. To play the part that Ray Milland played, several other films. And then one of his big first refusals is when Sam Goldwyn wanted to borrow him to play the part of Babyface Martin in Dead End, which was based on the huge hit, the Broadway play. And George thought about it, but there were certain aspects of the character he didn't like. And unfortunately, he took them too serious, I think, sometimes. And he just eventually turned down the part, which Bogart took and was another step forward in his career.
Well, with George, wasn't it like he wanted to not always be the hood? He wanted to be the good guy, and he didn't just want to be characterized as a gangster.
Well, that's true, because don't forget, he had a lot of known underworld associates, and that was pretty much common knowledge. And the more he played those kind of parts, he was afraid that people were going to start to think he really was a gangster. So he didn't really want to become so associated with those types of roles. And so, you know, that caused problems with the studio, because they realized, you know, playing those kind of roles were his most profitable image. And, you know, that's what they tried to cast him in, to the point where he just began turning down parts and refusing. For instance, he was offered the role that Jacques LaRue played in The Story of Temple Drake, the gangster Trigger. And he just turned that part down flat. I think that was his first big refusal, actually, at Paramount.
Wow.
Because
it was early.
Play a character like that.
Yeah.
He was early in his career.
Well.
And actually, he was basing, I think, his refusal because the character in the book has played a lot more evil than in
yes.
the movie. If you watch the movie, Jacques LaRue plays him like a gangster. I mean, he's a gangster. And there were some pretty questionable scenes for the time because it's pre-code.
Yeah.
But George said, no, if I do this part, people are going to think I'm like that. And, you know, to me, it's career suicide. So he said to the Paramount executives, I'll tell you what, I'll do the movie on one condition. You put $2 million in my bank account. Because he said, after this movie comes out, I'll be finished. And the interesting thing is, Jacques LaRue's career was really on the rise at that point. He took the part, and afterwards, his career kind of plateaued, and he began after that, you know, doing secondary roles and never really regained the momentum he had prior to that. So George might have been right in that refusal.
Jacques LaRue was pretty cute. He was like, you know, those hooded eyes. Did you ever see Virtue? Jacques LaRue was in that one. And Carol Lombard, it's a pre-code. It's really good. You can get that on YouTube. Carol plays a prostitute.
Oh.
Yes, Carol plays a prostitute.
Oh, I'll have to check that one out.
It's good.
That
you should. I'll send you the link to it.
What does LaRue play? A gangster?
Oh, yeah. A lazy shyster who hooks up with Carol's best friend, Mayo Metho, who is Humphrey Bogart's third wife.
Right.
The Batlin Bogies, and his nickname for her was Sluggy. She was wonderful in this film. She was so good in this film. She was very, you know, like, tough, high, been in the business for so long. And she has Toots. He plays Toots, her chiseler boyfriend. He lives off of her.
Hey. Oh, I got to check that one out. That sounds good. That sounds like a good movie. Yeah.
It is a good movie. And then, so did he get suspended for turning down that one?
Oh, yes, he got suspended several times. Like I said, he held the record for suspensions, I think, at Paramount during that period he was there, which was that was 6-7 years at Paramount. And because he was turning down a lot of parts because, he put a personal stamp on his portrayals. On if it didn't ring true to him, the character or whatever, he would turn the roles down. And that's the same thing happened to him when he signed at Warner Brothers. You know, he turned down so many good films at Warner's. And, that was the beginning of his decline after he left the studio, Warner Brothers.
Did he do Each Dawn I Die at Warner Brothers or at the
other
place?
Did. No, he left Paramount. He did a freelance at Universal called I Stole a Million. And then he was approached to do Hood Stacy at Warner Brothers, Each Dawn I Die. Jack Warner at first wasn't sure about bringing him on board because he didn't want to pay George a salary, which at that time was $5,000 a week. But he was talked into it, and Raft was such a success in that film that the studio put him under contract following it.
He and Cagney were great.
They were great teaming, yeah.
Oh, my
great
God. Team. And it was, I have that on my DVR, and every so often I want to get into the gangsta stuff.
Right.
Cagney's framed, and he helps this guy get out of jail, but then he turns. He becomes a real good mug. And goes back to jail for the rest of his life, and lets Cagney go free.
I always wondered about that.
Yes, and it was funny though. He ended up getting killed because they were going to get out, so he didn't stay there long. They started.
Well, that's true. I think he pretty much figured, look, I'm going to be in prison for life. I don't want to do this, so he might as well just sacrifice himself along with Alan Baxter, the rat who framed Cagney. So lets himself get killed at the end there.
Which one didn't they get? They like shank some guy in the movie theater, and he wanted Cagney to tell people that it was him. Like he's being, squealer, and that's how he escapes because he has this big grand getaway from the courthouse. And then poor Cagney gets in the what do you call those horrible things when they put you underground?
Solitary.
Yes.
Solitary.
And he goes nuts. And
he goes crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he didn't do anything.
No, but he almost becomes a criminal himself.
And you don't blame him.
He blows up at the warden there.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he's an innocent man, and, they put him through that torture in prison, and he eventually begins to crack himself, and it looks like, until George comes in and sets everything right, that Cagney himself is going to become a criminal when he comes out, kind of like what happens to Eleanor Parker in Caged.
I love that movie. It's one of my favorite women in prison films.
That's a great movie. Absolutely. Yep.
It's fabulous. Okay, so he did all these other things. Here's Nob Hill, Follow the Boys, Background to Danger. But so after he did Each Dawn I Die, he turned down, I guess, a really good movie and did The House Across the Bay, which was a stinkeroo. Do you remember what movie he turned down to do that one?
Yes. Well, after he did Each Dawn I Die, he did another prison movie with Bogart, the first of the two they made, called Invisible Stripes, which is actually my favorite George Raft movie.
I've never seen it. Check it out.
Oh, it's a great film. It's got a great supporting cast. It's got William Holden in his second part. It's got tough guys like Paul Kelly. My friend Mark Lawrence is in it. Joseph Downing, who he played the one who was stabbed in the prison movie, Each Dawn I Die.
Yeah.
So it's a really great cast. Good story. And after that, he was offered the part in High Sierra, based on the book by W.R. Burnett, who also wrote Little Caesar. And he was asked to play the lead part, the gangster Mad Dog Roy Earle. And George turned it down again. He thought about it, talked to some people, decided he didn't want to play a gangster who dies at the end. And there's some talk also that Bogart kind of was trying to talk George up taking the part because he wanted it.
Oh, I heard.
Telling George,
yeah.
Yeah. saying, you know, you're a big star, you know, you shouldn't be doing these parts, you die, you don't, you know, you don't get the girl at the end. And George took that to heart, I think, and said, okay, Jack, you know, I'm not Jack Warner, I'm not doing this part. So probably went to another suspension. And instead, he did this picture called The House Across the Bay, like you mentioned, which yes. really, it's really hard to understand why he would have turned down a quality film like High Sierra and do a real obvious B-movie, The House Across the Bay, where, of course, he plays a gangster who dies at the end.
So it's really strange.
His thinking there, you know? What was he thinking?
He didn't. He shouldn't have ever trusted Bogart. Come on. You know, yeah,
no,
it'll just ruin
exactly.
your career. And he's whispering in his ear all that other stuff.
Well, they said that Bogart was very devious, and he realized that George had these, you know,
insecurities
about playing these kind of parts. Insecurities,
and
exactly.
A lot because
he played on that to his own advantage. No, and it worked.
Yeah, you know what? I loved this quote you have in your book by James Cagney. Yeah, Bogart's about as tough as Shirley Temple.
Well, that's true. I mean, but he played the part so well.
That's he was very good.
Out of all the top movie gangsters of the era, Bogart played the gangster the most times. I mean, he played more than Cagney, more than Robinson, more than Raft. Duke Manti, The Petrified Forest,
yes.
And that's what pretty much typed him. From that on, Warner Brothers put him into those kind of parts, but rarely in the lead. He was usually playing the support to Cagney or Robinson or Raft. So, you know, and always the treacherous guy, you know, always the guy who ends up getting gunned down at the end.
And that changed for him because he became, you know, yeah, see, I love
yeah.
the boy. you know what I heard, too? I think I read it on IMDb. Edward G. Robinson was not really crazy about Bogart. I don't think a lot of them were that were in that genre.
Actually, it's funny you say that because they were good friends.
Really?
Were good friends. Yep. Yeah, they got along quite well. They weren't bosom buddies. But Robinson speaks very fondly of him in his autobiography, All My Yesterdays.
Huh.
And I've talked to Eddie's granddaughter, Francesca, and she said that there was never any problem between them. They got along very well. They worked well together, and they were quite friendly.
This was a quote I read, though. He said, Bogart would be in a restaurant getting drunk, and then he'd start a fight, and all the waiters would have to do the dirty work. You know, they push him away, and they'd fight for him. So that's what he said about Bogey, but I'm sure he did love him. I love Key Largo. They were so incredible.
Oh, yeah.
You know why I liked it?
Well, he might have... What's that?
I liked it because it was a quiet movie. You know, he didn't go over the top. Nobody went over... You know, maybe the gangsters a little bit, maybe Edward G., but it was like my favorite film that he and Lauren Bacall did together, because it was just
mine too.
A real yeah. movie about real people.
It's a beautiful
people.
It's a beautiful movie, actually, you know, because like you say, it's a quiet film. Bogart's character is very, very quiet and kind
yes.
of backstage. I mean, Eddie Robinson really is the star of the movie when you think about it. He's the colorful character, the gangster.
I love
and
how-
until the ending when
I'm sorry.
Until the ending when you know, Bogart comes through. Yeah, it's pretty much Robinson's film.
I loved Claire Trevor was amazing. You know,
oh, she was great. Yeah, I like her.
She was wonderful. I think she got Best Supporting Actress for that. And
yes, she did.
George was also, remember when he starts whispering in Lauren Bacall's ear, we don't know what that
yes.
he's saying. Of course, it's supposed
I've
to be
I've often
disgusting.
Wondered, what did he say to her? I know, what did he say to her in that scene? Yes,
I don't
obviously
think she
something.
Told, but... It's so funny. But I love that movie. Okay, so moving on, he did The House Across the Bay, and then he did a really good movie, which I love this movie, They Drive by Night.
That's right. He did that film before he turned down High Sierra, him and Bogart.
Yeah, he and Bogey played brothers.
That's right, truck driving brothers, yep. And they played really well together. Actually, when you watch the two films that they did, Invisible Stripes and They Drive by Night, they played really well, you know. But they apparently weren't the closest of friends either because, again, you know, Bogart was kind of deceiving George and it's taking, you know, not taking part in certain films that he ended up inheriting and becoming, you know, a bigger star than George did. But in later years, I mean, he spoke very fondly of Bogart. But I think there was some rivalry, let's say, during that time when they were at Warner Brothers together.
I thought that was a really, really good film. I thought he did great. Ida Lupino.
Yeah.
And I'm a real big fan of Ann Sheridan. I think she is such a cutie.
Oh, yeah.
She was great as his dame. And Ida wanted him. And it was, I love this movie. Then the next movie.
It's a great film. It's a great film.
It is a wonderful film, and I would recommend that to anyone. Here's the one I want to talk about. Manpower, because I believe that's when he and George C. Scott did not get along. He was hot for Edwards G. Robinson gets the girl who is Marlene Dietrich, which is a hoot. And George thinks she's just no good person. She's just out of the slammer.
Right.
She's just some horrible broad. And she ends up marrying Edward G. And off the thing, Edward G. was very erudite, very smart. He collected paintings and things like that. And I read that they would sit together talking about that stuff, Marlene and him. But Marlene ended up having, you know, she ended up having a thing with Raft during the show. But Raft thought that Edward G. was after her, but he wasn't. He got jealous. He was very jealous. And they did have a thing.
Well, that's partly true, I think. But I think the major problem was that, you know, like Jimmy Cagney said, he said that Edward G. Robinson had a tendency to take over the set of his movies, and he was trying to give George, you know, directions and acting and to do this, to do that. And I think George, you know, resented that because he said, well, I'm a professional, too. Maybe he wasn't as polished as Eddie was, but he was good in what he did. And I think he just, you know, got very resentful, and that grew until they finally had that fisticuffs thing happen on the set.
The thing you wrote about, oh, he turned down the Maltese Falcon as well.
Yes, he did. Yes. And that was a big mistake, obviously.
Didn't he say because it was made two times before or something like that?
Well, there were all sorts of reasons. George blamed his agent because his agent said, look, if the film has been filmed twice before, neither version was a success. Number two, the director is a first-timer. He's a great screenwriter, John Huston, but he's never directed a movie before.
Yeah.
And number three, he said the woman really isn't that attractive, referring to Mary Astor. So this is the stuff that George said.
Well, she really wasn't in that movie. That hair don't.
that hairdo's horrible. I know. I agree. I mean,
In The Great Lie and in that, I don't know where she gets it because it just made her look. She's a very, very pretty woman when her hair is an even thing. But I just was like, wow, she's supposed to be hot and beautiful. I don't get it. That hairdo. Was a don't.
Yeah, I couldn't see why Bogart fell for her. I thought he was better with his secretary Effie.
Oh, I love the secretary.
Lee Patrick.
Yes, me too. Poor.
And Lee Patrick actually played Bogey's girlfriend in Invisible Stripes.
Oh.
So they'd filmed a movie together before.
And she was engaged. How do you like that?
That's correct. Yes, she was. That's correct. She was. Yep.
She was
a good
head.
Actress. I liked her.
I did too. She was in Now Voyager. She was in a lot of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Very good actress.
Okay. So after he did Manpower, which I really liked too, I like that movie. It was creepy. Didn't people get injured? I mean, when you look at that film and all that rain coming through, and I think someone got injured on that.
Well, apparently George got injured. He fell off a pole. And he ended up, you know, I think he fell 20 feet or something.
Ouch.
And he ended up, getting hurt pretty bad. But I think it's the only injury that I know of on the film. And it did happen to George, unfortunately.
Poor George. And at this,
yeah, I know.
At this time now, I'm looking at these movies. What's background to Danger?
Well, what happened was, okay, this is, George went to Universal to make a movie called Broadway. Which is actually almost like a biography of his life. When he came back to Warner Brothers, he heard that they were doing the movie Casablanca. Now, Jack Warner in the old days would have said right off the bat, let's get George Raft for this, because like John Huston said, everything at the studio was intended for George Raft during those days. But at this point, Warner is saying, well, this would be a good movie for either Bogart or Raft. So all of a sudden, his name is being mentioned in the same breath as George Raft's, Bogart's. And contrary to what a lot of people say, George never turned down the part of Rick in Casablanca. He actually campaigned for it. But what happened was that producer Hal Wallace and director Michael Curtiz didn't want to use Raft. They wanted Bogart. So that's what happened. They got And Raft, you know, that he saw that the writing was on the wall, that Bogart was going to become the studio's new big star. So they offered him a part in a movie called Background to Danger, which was kind of a Casablanca type story. You had Sidney Greenstreet, you had Peter Lorre in the movie.
Oh, didn't he get into a fight with Peter Lorre?
Well, that's the story. The story goes that Peter Lorre got kind of, you know, bored between scenes at a part when George Raft was tied to a chair and out of boredom began blowing cigarette smoke in his face. And George kept on telling him, Peter, please stop, please stop, please stop. And Peter wouldn't. So finally, when George was untied, he ran into Peter's dressing room and apparently slugged him, cold cocked him. You know, so you don't do that to George Raft. I mean, you know, so that's the story. But actually, you know what? I have a bit of a problem with that story, because if you ever watch Background to Danger, the scene when George is in that chair, he's not tied up. He's not tied up with a rope or anything. He's just sitting in that chair. So there probably was some kind of a blow up between him and Lorre at one point, but I don't think it had to do with him being tied to a chair.
Yeah, I heard that he was making fun of George too. And
yeah, that's probably more likely. Actually, I think yeah.
And he was just being a little devilish imp. So that's funny. He worked with George Raft. George worked with Sidney Greenstreet, Peter Lorre, both of whom were in
Casablanca,
and the Maltese Falcon.
That's correct. Yeah. So anyway, Background to Danger is a good movie, but it didn't catch the same kind of fire that Casablanca did. And finally, after that movie was shot, George decided he wanted to, you know, take control of his own career. And he went to Jack Warner and said, you know, I want out of the studio. And Warner was prepared to pay George money to get him out of the contract. Instead, George, he either misunderstood or he was so eager to be free. He claims he was eager to be free that he actually wrote Jack Warner a check for $10,000 to be let out of his contract.
Oh, yes, so, and he cashed it.
and Jack Warner ran to the bank to cash it before he could change his mind.
But he
wanted to be a free agent. He wanted to take control of his own career. And that, again, was, I would say, the beginning of the decline, because he might not have liked, you know, being at Warner's because of, you know, whatever was going on there, but they gave him the best material. I mean, the same thing happened with Bogart and Cagney. You know, they got their best films at Warner's. Both of them wanted to leave. Jim Cagney left to form Cagney Productions. He made, you know, films that just didn't really click with the public. So what happens? He goes back and does White Heat, which is one of his biggest hits.
I love that film.
That's the film that really, you know, people, I think, remember most with Cagney, next to Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Yeah, he was really good in that. And so I'm looking at these. So these were like kind of la-di-da pictures. But during all this time, he has the reputation everywhere that he is a hoodlum and a gangster.
Yes, yes, yes.
He wasn't a hoodlum or a gangster. I think he wished, you know, he had those associations, and what could he deny them? They'll mow you down.
Well, in the 20s, he was on the fringes of the underworld. You know, delivered beer for Oney Madden. He carried a gun. He admitted he carried a gun during those days. I don't know if more was to it, because George never really said too much outside of the fact he drove a beer truck or was, you know, a guard on those truck runs.
Yeah.
But he knew a lot of these guys. Don't forget, he grew up, you know, during that period, you know, with street kids and that, and a lot of those street kids grew up to be pretty well-known names in the underworld. When he was dancing in those nightclubs in the 20s, like George said, most of these clubs were owned by gangsters.
They were speakeasies? You know,
Speakeasies, exactly, and nightclubs. I mean, he got to know a lot of these New York hoods. He even admitted, he said, during my time, I knew or met all of them. I mean, he knew everybody from, you know, Lucky Luciano to Mad Dog Call to Dutch Schultz to Al Capone. I mean, so he did have, you know,
Bugsy Siegel,
those associations.
Who he let.
Bugsy Siegel was his good friend of his, yeah.
$100,000 to.
Yes.
Never got a cent back, and he was invited to his home that night, the night that Bugsy got mowed down.
Yep. And he wisely didn't show up that night because he, you know, was playing bridge or something, I believe. And it was late. And by the time, you know, the game was over, he had heard that Bugsy had been shot down in the home of Virginia
Hill.
Virginia Hill, thank you. I'm thinking of Virginia Pine for some reason. Virginia Hill, of course. So, yeah, fortunately, he wasn't there. But again, like you say about lending him $100,000, George was extremely generous with people. I mean, he actually literally gave the shirt off his back to somebody if someone, you know, needed it. He was very generous that way. So when it came to Siegel asking him for $100,000, even though George Reed didn't have the money, you know, he went and borrowed the money from his agent as an advance on some pictures he was going to be doing. Never got it. And, you know, that was a bad time for him to be doing that because he was without a studio contract.
Couldn't he have ever just said no to these guys, or was he afraid if he said no, he'd be in trouble? You know what I mean?
You know, who knows? I mean, that's possible, too. I mean, I talk about his incredible generosity, but, you know, maybe you don't say no to someone like Benny Siegel, you know, because he knew that Siegel had a hell of a temper, you know,
yeah.
And was prone to violence. So
all of them.
It's possible.
It could be, because that's what made, he was very, I see a lot of the times that George would react and get angry or something. I think it was because of his insecurity about his lack of education. And he
definitely,
he
yeah.
felt that very strongly. This is my armchair psychoanalyst. I'm psychoanalyzing him. Everybody, I just was. And then I wondered, could he gave $100,000 to Bugsy Siegel. Couldn't he have given that to Grace? Did he use Grace in some way as a person so he didn't really, even though he loved these people, have to get involved with them?
Yes. You know, that's been another theory, too, that people have said, is that, you know, she was kind of like a cover for him, because even though he would say later in life, like in the Louis Yablonsky autobiography, when he talks about the women, how much he loved them and everything, but Grace wouldn't grant him a divorce. But a lot of people have also said, well, maybe that was his cover, because, you know, he loved these women, but he also loved his freedom, because he was a very popular man about town in Hollywood during those years.
Yeah.
And so maybe he never really wanted to get more serious than he had to, and so Grace was always a convenient stall for him.
That's what I think.
So that's possible. It's
that's
possible.
How I felt it, because if he had really, really wanted it, I believe if he came up with enough dough, she would have done it. And
do you think so?
I do. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe because she's...
I don't know, but that's it is interesting to speculate, because, like I say, when you read his book that was written back in 74, I believe, the Yablonsky book, and he talks a lot about that, but he always says he wanted to, so much to get married to these women, but Grace wouldn't give him the divorce. But at that stage of his life, he could say that, because no one's going to know to the contrary, right? But at the time, it's very possible that he might just have preferred to stay single and have a good time. And when the romances were getting so serious, like, don't forget Betty Grable said she would have married George the first week they met. Maybe that was something that kind of scared George a bit.
Hold on one second. I got to stop
sure.
this. Well, I think a lot of those guys did, because I think Spencer Tracy used it. Give me the break about he's some good Christian. He has sex with everybody in the whole wide world, as far as I know, from what I've mm-hmm. read. And then
there,
who is the other person? Oh, and he pretty much admitted it. Robert Mitchum. He stayed married to his wife. He had numerous affairs. Shirley MacLaine wanted to marry him. And I think she said that he felt safe and he would go home to mama. You know, he didn't want to do it again. And she let him do what he wanted to do. And but he did not want to leave her, and he didn't want to remarry. He had his kids. He had his wife. And he wanted to still have his fun, but stay married.
Well, I mean, you know, Jimmy Cagney was staunchly married, you know, and never had any scandal placed against him at all, because he was completely devoted to his wife. So he was one of the few actors who actually had a very good marriage and lasted, you know, until his death, because he never strayed. He was, his wife was his life.
Isn't that so nice? He said he only loved two dames in his life. One was his wife. I don't know if he used dames, but he loved, as a friend, he loved Joan Blondell. They were great friends.
Yep.
And it's amazing to me, because, you know, you're in that in Hollywood, and there's this all these women who want to come hither yonder to your lair, and that he actually, you know, had the fortitude and to say no and to just be in love with his wife. And I salute that, because that ain't easy.
Well, no, he found out later on that a lot of his leading ladies had crushes on him, but he says, never even occurred to me at the time, because he never even looked at that as being anything to consider. You know, he'd do his job and go home to his wife, and he was just a very down-to-earth, decent guy, and never was any scandal attached to him as far as that goes.
No, I have never read anything scandalous about him. You're correct.
No. Nothing. Absolutely.
I love this one. This Cesar Romero, he seems to be the resident gay of classic Hollywood who always says someone could go both ways or could be gay or could be this. I've read him say it about, like, I don't know how many people. He said about George. He said it about, who was the other guy? Desi Arnaz, whatever, you know. He was always in these books as a gossip saying this or that.
Yeah.
Who knew? I don't know. Who could care less?
Well, I know George wasn't. I mean, you know, there was that little question there at one point in his career that because he was, you know, such a man about town type of person, maybe he did go in that direction. But when I talked to Lou Yablonsky, who knew George very well in the later years of his life, he said, oh, no, he says not at all. He said George was 100% straight.
I believe that, too. But I don't know. Yeah. I think Cesar Romero just liked to say that about everybody.
Well, maybe that's why they called him Butch, right?
Is that what they called him?
That was his nickname, yep.
Oh, boy. Yep. too funny. So all this stuff was happening. His career was kind of going in the toilet a little bit. He did a film called Christmas Eve.
Right.
Did you ever see that film?
Yes, I did a few times, actually, yeah. It's not really a bad movie.
It isn't.
It's really not a bad film. You know, it's kind of cute. Again, it's not a major production like most of those films that George made after leaving Warner Brothers. I don't think it was, you know, an advantage to his career by any stretch. But it's a nice little movie. I liked it.
I did, too. And Anne Harding played way older than she was. I think she was their adopted mother or something.
I believe so. And then you got Randolph Scott, George Brent, you know. So pretty good cast for that kind of a movie.
Yes, very much so. And I watched it, too. I liked that movie as well. And then he was in Stage Door Canteen, which all of
briefly
people were in, just for...
Yeah.
He was doing dishes or something, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he and his friend Mac Gray are in the kitchen doing dishes, and they mention a sports statistic at one point, and that's like you blink and you miss some kind of thing.
In your book, you say how generous he is, and he met two young actresses. One was his future love, Betty Grable, and the other one was Lucille Ball.
Yes.
And he gave
Lucy... He never dated Lucy. He was just very good friends with her.
And he loaned her $100, gave her $100 and a ride home. I don't know what that was from, but that's in your book. And she never forgot that. I even think she paid him back. One of the people who actually paid him back. He said he lent out at least $1 million and never got anything back.
Oh, I'm sure of that. Absolutely. He was, like I say, so generous, you know, and he saw somebody down on their luck. And he was, like, they called him the softest touch in Hollywood. You know, all you had to do was give him a sob story and he'd pull out his roll of cash and give you some money. They wanted to ask him, he said, well, don't you realize you're being taken advantage of by these people? And George says, sure, I know I am. He says, but how can I sleep at night if I know I turned down somebody who really needs a buck for, you know, for a meal or something?
What,
so that was his philosophy, basically. Oh, yeah. He had a big heart, very big heart.
After he stopped seeing, you know, or saying, I'm not going to fall in love, I'm not going to get into these heavy-duty relationships, in your book it says he mostly saw hookers and, like, young starlets.
Yes. Yeah, he just didn't want to have, you know, get... He didn't want to... Again, maybe he really was serious about having, you know, a nice family relationship, you know, with someone. So he didn't want to get his heart broken again after the Betty Grable incident, and so decided to just, you know, be casual in his relationships after that. So that kind of lends credence to the fact that maybe he did want to get married and have a family.
Yeah, it does, but I still ponder, and it's still a question. I'm not, you
it's
know.
It's a question.
Only
sure,
George.
Sure it is.
George had a lot of, you know, a lot of stuff in him. Like I said, his insecurity about where he was from, his insecurity about his supposed lack of intelligence sometimes or whatever.
Yeah.
I've seen him dancing. He was a really good dancer. Fred Astaire complimented him on his dancing. James Cagney complimented on his dancing. And yet he stayed in Hollywood. He never went back to Broadway, right? He stayed in Hollywood and continued
in Hollywood
to do roles. And the next one I think of mention would be Some Like It Hot.
Well, in the 50s, yeah, his career was at a really low ebb by that point. He even ventured into television briefly. But, yeah, he had a really good role in a movie called Rogue Cop, where he played probably his most – that was probably his most vicious gangster he ever played in film.
Was that the guy whose brother was a priest and got murdered?
No, that's Red. That's Red Light.
Oh.
Yeah, that George plays the priest's brother. He owns a trucking company, and Raymond Burr and Harry Morgan are the two killers in that one.
Oh, the bad guys, boy.
Good. Yeah, that's a good. That's actually another really good George Raft film in the 40s. But Rogue Cop. He plays the killer, the gangster, and like I say, out of all the gangsters he's played in films, that's probably his most ruthless characterization. Then he did another gangster, and that was a very popular film. It looked like his career might be on the upswing, but then he was doing more conventional films again that didn't do much for his career. And in 1959, he did Some Like It Hot, where he played another ruthless gangster, but of course it's not really a huge part in the movie, but it's a very memorable characterization. They have him participating in the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
That was a creepy scene. I know this is a comedy, but I have to say that scene totally freaks me out. I can't watch it.
It's a pretty intense scene. I agree with you.
Very brutal. And, you know, me, I always see, like I said, that really happened. And then I get sad.
That's history. That's mob history right there, actually. Done in a comedic movie, which is really interesting.
Yeah, he played Spats somebody, right? He always had those shoes.
Spats Columbo, yep.
And
which is like that was his last major film role, actually.
He was good in that. It's funny that I don't know who he is, which part he played, but Edward G. Robinson's son was in the flick too.
He played the guy who jumps out of the cake at the banquet and machine guns them.
Oh no! Yeah,
which is interesting. Which is interesting, given the relationship that Robinson and George had back during the making of Manpower, that he would be the one who guns down George Raft in that movie.
Poor George. I read in your book. Where else would I have read it? I read your book that Marilyn Monroe wanted her and George to skip off together.
Yeah, do the tango into the sunset at the end of the movie, which really would have made no sense when you think about it, because he's a murderer. They never allowed that to happen. But that was her idea. She thought it'd be kind of fun to have them, Spats and her character, do that little tango off into the sunset there and the movie on that note. But that just wouldn't have been feasible.
No, especially, after the code, the rule of the movies were if you did a crime, you had to pay for it.
You had to pay a price at that.
Right.
Exactly.
You couldn't just get away with it. You had to pay the price.
No.
And I like the priest one, too. And then, I'm looking here. I know he did Sextet.
Yes. His second last film.
Was that what was the other film?
Well, Sextet was Mae West's last film. And interestingly, she got her start with George Raft. And so in that movie, her last film, he did a brief cameo with her in an elevator. After Some Like It Hot, George did a film called Jet Over the Atlantic. That was his last featured role. Following that movie, he began doing bits and cameos in movies like Ocean's 11, The Patsy, The Ladies' Man.
Oh, yeah.
Those who think young.
Martin and Lewis loved him.
Oh, yeah, they did very much. Absolutely. When they came to Hollywood, they said that George was one of the first people to invite them over to his house. So they got to know him well, and they both really had a very high respect for George.
I have to ask you about those shoes that he wears at the pool as well.
Right.
I'm looking at them. I have to expand them. Do they have, like, holes in them on the side? They don't have any tie or anything, right? There's, like, this, funky.
I think so. They were shoes he had. They were his favorite shoes. Apparently, George had very small feet. Which might be why he was a good dancer.
Yeah.
And he would wear those shoes, all the time, like even at the pool. So they obviously had a great attraction to him.
Yeah, you showed him at the pool. And I'm like, I gotta ask
him
for a close-up of this, because this is so these are funky shoes. I can't get out, how they're really
I know, they're totally, yeah, different kind of shoes, that's for sure.
Yeah, but
yeah,
he loved them.
They were his favorite pair.
And he did a lot of interviews, didn't he?
He did some, yeah. He did. I don't know if he did a lot, but he certainly did some.
And then he was asked to be like a host in nightclubs and stuff like that, right? Was that after his film career?
Well, yeah, he was first asked to be the host of a casino nightclub in Cuba, Havana, which until Castro took over the country, and you know that was the end of that enterprise.
That must have been so frightening. It sounded horrible.
Absolutely. He was basically held prisoner in that hotel with other guests, you know, until the whole thing kind of cooled over a little bit, which is in the book, of course, the whole detailed story there. It's a good story because it's almost like a scene from a movie.
Yeah.
You know, he could have been in. You know, it was quite an experience. And then in the 60s, he became the owner, the host of the Colony Club, which was, his career was pretty much gone at that point, film career. So that gave him a whole new opportunity to have a good life that kind of suited with his personality and his image and everything. But again, that fell through, sadly, because I believe it had to do with his club was so successful that, you know, rival nightclub owners in London began planting stories about his, you know, criminal ties.
Oh, that was terrible.
Underworld connections.
Yeah. He left the country. He was basically kicked out of the country, and he couldn't come back.
He was booted up. No, he was banned. He tried so hard to get back in, but no, they banned him from London.
Yes.
He said that was, out of all the career setbacks he had, he said that was the one that hit him the hardest, was being banned from London, because he loved London. He loved his job. It was a great job he had there. People respected him again. He had the respect he hadn't had for many years. You know, people would come to the club to see him, and he was apparently a very gracious host. And so it was kind of like a dream job for him at that point of his career. So when he was banned from London, it just hit him very hard.
I don't blame him. Can you imagine? It's like bad enough to be dumped, but then a whole country dumps you.
Well, that's just it. I mean, he had so many bad experiences in his life. I know.
It breaks my heart.
That could have been a nice, happy ending for him, but unfortunately, you know, it didn't turn out that way.
Because of his, I think he pled guilty to some little bit of tax evasion or something like that.
Yes.
And I think that's what they were going from, wasn't it?
Well, that was another mistake he made, because he got involved with this company called Consumer Marts of America, where he was, again, signing papers and putting himself into a position that when the company went under, he was financially liable for the losses, and taxes apparently weren't taken off his money. And so they hit him with this income tax thing. And that was another devastating blow to him. But a lot of people came to his aid. Frank Sinatra offered him a check up to $1 million to help his case. But George never accepted any of those offers. He was very proud.
I know.
Unfortunately, the judge went easy on him, fortunately, so, you know, it did turn out okay, but, you know, he was not a tax evader. He just wasn't a very good businessman.
No, and I just see him as a very sensitive man. He was, to me, an incredibly sensitive man.
I think so.
Yeah, me too. And I just, I thought there's some really poopy people around him, and...
Yes.
I loved the book. I learned so much about him.
And, well, I'm glad. I appreciate that.
And I always liked George Raft, but now I really like him through his book. And I also go, it was sad too. So.
Oh, yeah, it was. Yeah.
What did he do after they banned him from London?
Well, he came back to the U.S. and, I guess he picked up a little bit of television work here and there. And towards the end of his life, he was actually working as a reservations clerk for the Riviera Hotel in Las Vegas. So he was, making a paycheck, and he was living off Social Security, but his finances weren't that good. He's, sold his beautiful home in Coldwater Canyon.
Yeah.
He was living in an apartment.
To give Bugsy Siegel the money.
Yeah, well, that's just it. I mean, he just didn't have, he spent too much. Like he said, I earned about $10 million during my career. He said, part of the loot went to horses, part went to women, and the rest I spent foolishly. And that's pretty good summation, I think, of why his finances were the way they were at the end. People like, I believe Frank Sinatra was actually taking care of George, too, during those years to make sure that he had at least a comfortable life.
Good. Well, that was really nice. That's really nice that someone was there with George. I read in your book, it said, his wife dies finally in 1970.
Yes. Yes.
Finally, Grace croaks. And they ask him about it, and he says that I just like watching the dames and the broads go by. I you know, I don't care anymore.
No, he was at that point of his life, and he was ill. You know, he was suffering from emphysema pretty bad.
A lot of smoking.
He was a smoker, and his mother actually died of asthma, so it could have been a hereditary thing as well. But he did smoke heavily, so I think it was 3 packs of Lucky Strikes a
day. Yikes!
You know, so yeah, he was, and you know, having that kind of a background with his mother and that, I'm sure he didn't have the strongest lungs in the world to start with. So towards the end of his life, his doctor said basically he was a respiratory cripple.
Poor
dude. Which was sad. And then he ended up with leukemia. So yeah, he wasn't in the best of shape in those later years. But it's interesting, on YouTube, there's an old Mike Douglas show that was filmed the year that George died, where George is the co-host, and they're talking. And George passed away that year. He comes across really sharp, a true gentleman. But he looks, you can see he's 85, and he's, you know, looking pretty ill. But, that was the last television interview he gave. And he passed away later that year in November.
He was something. He was something.
Yes, he was. He was quite a character, like I say.
He was. And it's. Do you think he regretted not taking all those parts that made Bogey a star?
Well, Lou Yablonsky said that he felt that George ended up, you know, he ended his life basically a contented man. I mean, he probably had regrets about some. I think he regretted turning down the Maltese Falcon, definitely, because that really put Bogart in the map, and that kind of began to lessen George's importance at the Warner Brothers. So I think he did regret that. Maybe not too many of the other films. I'm sure he would have liked to have gotten Casablanca, but, you know, he was out of the running in that one. But, no, I think, you know, he basically just lived with the mistakes he made, and he lived life on his own terms. And I think, you know, when you do that, you can't really say too much to the negative.
No, but I wonder if he was lonely, you know?
He probably was.
And that's what I, you know, when I read books, I see, you know, I get emotionally involved in biographies.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, oh, he sounds so lonely. Oh.
Well, he had a lot of friends. I mean, he had friends. I mean, he might have been, you know, not, you know, as popular with people as he was back in his heyday. But he had, you know, he had friends like Sinatra and that. And, you know, I think he was, you know, basically pretty happy.
Good. I hope so. You know, because I'll still ponder and feel bad for George.
Oh yeah. Well, I know he didn't have the same kind of, you know, end of career that Cagney had, or, you know, Robinson, or even Bogart. You know, Bogart died quite young, but, you know, he was still very popular at the time of his passing. And Edward G. Robinson was still working, and Jimmy Cagney was happy in retirement. You know, but all of them began to suffer. You know, the abilities of age.
Yes,
Jimmy Cagney ended up with major health problems, and Bogart, of course, cancer, Eddie Robinson, cancer, George, you know, emphysema, and leukemia.
He died after, Edward G. died after making Soylent Green. And I have
That's
to
right.
tell you, I loved his character in that. He should have gotten a Best Supporting Actor as Saul.
Of course he should have.
He
of
was
course he
amazing
should've.
In that film. He didn't get anything, right? He never got any awards.
No. He got an honorary Oscar.
Oh, ooh,
you know, unfortunately, he passed away before he could accept it, but he knew he was going to be awarded that.
Good.
But no, for an actor with his incredible talents, I mean, look at the
range.
Movies he made.
The range.
Oh, the range. And not even a nomination throughout his career. I mean, that's just criminal.
It really
you know,
is.
Honestly.
He was amazing.
I mean, look at him in Double Indemnity. That should have definitely gotten him a Best Supporting
Actor.
He
was so good. And you see him, he could play comedy, Brother Orchid.
Anything. Yes, Brother Orchid or anything like that.
He was just, he
just
could
a
play.
Total.
I love that guy. And I just, I mean, it's
Me
such,
too.
Such a miserable movie, but he was so charming and adorable in it. And then his death scene.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he knew he was dying at that point. And the story goes that he spent as much time as he possibly could on the set because he knew this would be his last movie, and he wanted to enjoy that camaraderie one final time. So he spent, even when he wasn't filming, he'd be on the set, you know, as much as he could. He was quite ill, but you know, he just wanted to remember that the memories are after a 40-something year career.
He had an amazing career.
Yeah,
amazing.
An amazing career, absolutely. And it's just unfortunate that he never could hung around long enough so he could actually accept that honorary Oscar himself. His widow did.
Well, that happens a lot of times with these people.
Oh, yeah.
They are dead by the time they get these things, which stinks.
I know. How sad.
I know. What was I going to ask you? Oh, yes. There was a movie made about him. And when? What was that? 60s? The 60s?
Oh, the George Roth story.
Yes.
Yes, yes. That was, what year is that? Oh, early 60s. I had to check, but I'm not sure off the top of my head when that was made. But yeah, that was not a very accurate biography, let's put it that way.
How is the guy who played him? I never heard of him before in my life.
Well, Ray Danton. Oh, Ray Danton was as good as could be expected. He was a dancer too, actually, but he was certainly much taller than George, for one thing. I mean, you know, a good foot or so taller than George Roth was. Danton was a very tall man.
Wow.
But the movie itself, I mean, outside of one or two scenes, the scene where he meets Al Capone, played by Neville Brand in that movie, that's pretty accurate. That pretty much did happen. But it mentions nothing about Oney Madden. It mentions nothing about the Hollywood romances he had. So there are a lot of. It's an okay film just to watch on its own, but it's not a biography, really.
Yeah, I never watched it.
That still must be made. It still must be made. The ultimate George Roth biography.
But yes, there should be another ultimate George Roth biography. But who
yes,
in the
indeed.
World could play George Roth? Who could play Edward G. Robinson? Who could play these
Well,
guys?
When the Yablonsky book came out, I remember this back in 1974, and they asked George if a movie were to be made, who he'd want to play him. And he said Al Pacino, who I think at the time would have been probably about the best choice there was, because Pacino could dance the tango very well. You know, short guy. I think that would have been good. Not now, though. He's way too old, but I think at the time he would have been
sure.
a very good choice. But
it's a shame.
But I can't think of anybody today who could do the part. They're just not the same talent out there.
I don't feel like that either. I am a humongous.
No.
That's why I do the show. And I have my Facebook page, True
right.
Stories of Tinseltown. Please like it, okay, Stone? Like it and follow it. And
I will.
This is like my love. I love doing this. I do a couple other podcasts. One's a broadcast. We do women's issues and things like
right.
that. And another one is more entertainment-y, more
well,
modern
good.
Stuff. And this here is my passion and love because
I can tell.
Adore classic movies. I love the actors.
Oh, me too.
I love the movies. Pre-code. I just love them all. And
me too. Yes.
I have to be honest, I don't like musicals too much. That is my thing. I really don't. And Westerns? No.
Uh-oh. If you saw my webpage, you'll notice I write Westerns.
Do you really?
Did you not check out my webpage? I sent you the link to
that.
Oh,
I checked you everything. But, you know, you have so much stuff. I tell you, we were emailing for such a long time. I feel like he could write my biography.
Yeah, probably. Yeah,
everything.
Maybe we will.
And I feel like I could write his because he has had quite an interesting life himself, which I'd love you to come on my the podcast with my co-host because we can talk about your other stuff
to.
And it's a lot of fun. I got engaged.
Well, check out
pardon
me,
I got engaged to Ed Asner on my last podcast.
I heard about that.
He was so romantic.
Ed Asner, that's pretty cool actually.
I know.
Yeah,
he's sharp and cool and he was so romantic.
Oh yeah,
yeah. So
he's a neat guy, I
love him. I just love him and he was such a darling. So we'll talk about that because I'd love to have you on that because you have such an interesting life.
Well, I would love to, Grace. Please let me know. Like I say, check out my website. Though, look at the.
I have to be better because I have to. Yeah, I'll look.
Well, you'll see. I've done about 21 books so far, and I have done a lot of Western novels. So I would love to come on there and talk about my writing in general and whatever. So
and your past stuff that I find so fascinating. So that would be wonderful. And
well, let's do that.
I was going to ask you off of this, but what the heck? Because he really does. I mean, he knows everything except my shoe size. And that's about the truth.
Cool. There you go. That's
so,
not bad.
It's been a pleasure, George.
It's been my pleasure, Grace. Thank you so much.
I love the book. If you love Edward G. Robinson, if you love that kind of stuff, it is a great book. I read it and loved it, and of course felt sad for him because I am a very, you know, person who feels sad for everybody in the world kind of person. But I just felt he was lonely, and I just wish I think being associated with all those hoodlums just didn't help him out too much.
No, I think that's the problem. A lot of people thought because of that association that he himself was. And again, he did have, you know, ties to the underworld and did have, you know, some criminal activity in his early years. But I really don't think it's fair to classify him as a gangster, which
And I think it's so wrong. And he was trying to get out of that. And when, you know, you have these, like, mobsters coming up to you, what's George supposed to say? Amps, Gracie. No, he can't do that. You know, because he's afraid.
No, I know. I mean, you know.
You don't know what these people will do.
Like Bugsy Siegel.
You know what they can do.
Bugsy Siegel had a hair trigger temper, and a couple times George put himself in line of that because of things. And, you know, he realized he had to calm him down because Siegel, you never knew how far he could go with that temper.
And that's why he gave him the $100,000.
I think so. I think that was probably a good reason.
I really do. When I saw half of this stuff, I'm like, oh, George, his insecurities, his this, his that. One thing that cracked me up, though, I just have to say this one thing. Almost every guy I meet, my 20-year-old boyfriend, other people have always said, people I just know, guys I know, he said, George said that he lost his virginity at 12 years old by a nurse, an older nurse, and it lasted for a couple of years on and off. I have heard that from everybody. For some reason, 12 is the year, and it's either a nurse or their babysitter.
Hmm. Are you talking about George?
I'm talking about men.
Oh, in general.
About losing their virginity. I know, it's so funny, but
I wouldn't know about that one. That's an interesting comment, though.
It is. It's because they, what do you have to say that for? Who cares?
But you can even add your school teacher nowadays.
Well,
in some instances. I've been hearing lots about that, so there you go.
Remember years ago, what was her name? Mary something Turneau. And she fell in love with her very young. And they got married. She looked great. But look, and she got pregnant, you know, and then she had to go to jail for 8 years and they got married. Now it wouldn't be proper. It wasn't proper then.
I know. That's so weird. I know. That was a strange situation there.
Yeah. I don't think George would have done that. He would have had more respect, especially because Mary J. Letourneau was married and had, I think, 5 kids. So I know.
Well, there you go. Absolutely.
He would have been a gent. And I think a swell gent. And you wrote a book about a swell gent.
I think so.
I know you did, and I read it, and I loved it, and
I appreciate that.
I felt, you know, when you read a biography, you want to feel like you know the person, and you want to feel like, you know, oh, I feel sad for him, too, and all this other stuff, and I certainly did. Oh, one more thing. My friend John, his dad went to dinner. His dad and mom went to dinner with George, and he got some silver dollars from him.
I know that story. That's you talking about John O'Dowd?
Yes. Yeah, you.
Yes, because that picture's in the book.
Yes, it's wonderful.
That photograph. It's in the book there with them at dinner with him.
Yes, he held it back from me, little devil. He's going to come back on the show when he gets his Barbara Payton picture book out. I read his Barbara Payton. He was like my first guest on this show, and
I know.
I was obsessed with that book. It was incredible, and it was...
It's an amazing book. The work he put into that book is, like, mind-blowing.
It is.
I mean, he researched that from top to bottom. I mean, I told him, I said, this is really a... It's not surprising it's gotten all the kudos it has, because it's quite a story.
And it should be a movie.
Well, that's what he's hoping for. He's hoping they're going to still do a film. I believe there was some kind of interest going on with that.
There is. Someone's writing a screenplay now. So let's hope this goes through, because...
I hope so. I mean, he's devoted himself to a lot of years on that, and I really would like to see that come through for him.
It was an amazing book. I loved it. So.
Oh, yeah.
We love you, John. Your book is great, and I can't wait to see the picture book. And
you betcha. Yes, absolutely.
And more than this, this is the lovely... Oh, you know what your name reminds me? Stoney Curtis.
What's
from
that?
The Flintstones.
Stoney Curtis.
They used to do those names, Cary Grant.
I remember Cary Grant and Stoney Curtis.
Rock Quarry. And
Rock Quarry, right.
And Margrock.
And Margrock, right. Oh, God, I grew up on those cartoons. I remember them well.
Oh, they're so funny. Anyway, I want to thank you to Stone. And I am telling you guys, check out that book. You won't be sorry. If you're a fan, see, I wasn't like, he's not like my top 10 actor or anything, but I loved the book. It was so well written. And
well, thank you so much.
Tell us the name of your book, my friend.
It's George Raft, The Man Who Would Be Bogart.
And I'll link you to Amazon and to other things for him. And he also has something cool on YouTube. So we'll do some linking here.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. And we'll be in touch about you coming on my other show.
Yes, please. I would look forward to doing that again. For sure.
Because you have so many, you know, like I said, we know a lot about each other now. Don't tell anybody.
Yes, we do.
Don't tell
That is the truth.
Anyone. Yeah. And, so it'll be fun. I want to talk about some of your other endeavors and things. This guy's had quite the life. So it
will
be a
pleasure. Well, thank you. I would enjoy that very much.
Okay, great. Okay, everybody.
Okay.
So thank you so much, Joan. You were wonderful.
Thank you so much, Grace. I really enjoyed it.
And I hope you guys loved it. And George Raft is fab. I put some stuff on my Facebook page about George. He was my tribute of the day man today, because we were going to do the interview. And thanks, everybody, for listening. Please keep listening. I have some really great guests coming up. Wait till you hear. And thank you, Stone Wallace. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.